Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to start the morning at the hop, then learn what we need to know about the avian flu. At 10, we'll hear about a Vermont company that makes wonderful soaps and skincare products. And we'll finish the morning talking to a WDEV All-Star who used to host this show, Mike Smith. But let's begin in Hanover, New Hampshire, at a venue that hosts a number of outstanding cultural events and is undergoing a bit of a makeover. Here to bring us up to date on the Hopkins Center for the Arts at Dartmouth, or the HOP, is Director Mary Lou Oleski. Mary Lou, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. It's just wonderful to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. Listeners, to ask Mary Lou about the HOP or to share an event you've attended there, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mary Lou, for anyone who's never been to the HOP, how do you describe it?
Well, you know, it has a rich and amazing history because it's kind of the early older sister of Lincoln Center. Mm. So same architect, same five arches you see on the Metropolitan Opera, on the front of the Metropolitan Opera. And so when you come into the Arts District, which is growing now with the addition of our newly renovated Hood Museum and more to come, you kind of feel like you're transported. You know, we're essentially a Lincoln Center here at Dartmouth College for our region, and it's a growing and exciting time for the arts here at Dartmouth.
That is exciting. What is your mission in serving the Dartmouth and the nearby community?
Well, thanks for saying that. We really are committed to being a cultural destination and a cultural support system for our entire community. That includes all of Northern New England and the Upper Valley, especially, and the Dartmouth College. As it relates to Dartmouth, of course, we also have a number of arts academic departments in the district, and they are wonderful, not only teachers, but actually creators. So there's a lot going on at the HOP. In fact, we're in the middle of a run from our theater department right now of Rent in its mm-hmm. anniversary year. And our Dartmouth Symphony Orchestra really serves as a regional orchestra, and they'll be performing on Saturday night with Mahler's Fourth and a wonderful, wonderful companion piece from Samuel Barber. So it's that kind of relationship to not only our communities, but also our sense of place, right? Like we're here in this beautiful rural community, and artistically we also amplify themes of what it means to be on this land.
Mm. Now, in the span of just a few days this week, one could have heard a lecture from the metalsmith and sculptor Marilyn De Silva, as you mentioned, seen Rent. You could have watched Licorice Pizza, West Side Story. My apologies to any of events that I omitted. Anais Mitchell, Bonnie Light Horseman were there last week. Honestly, I want to come live at the HOP. but what kind of mix of events and exhibits do you try to schedule there?
Well, also in that mix was a work called Welcome to Indian Country, which, you know, acknowledges the land that we're on and was a musical celebration of the heritage, tribal heritages that intersect here at Dartmouth. So we have this rich history as it relates to the land, not just in terms of the environment, but also in terms of the peoples of the elders of this land. So we start there. You know, we try to amplify stories that are otherwise historically underrepresented, but also recognize that there are communities of families and school children who also come to the HOP for performances and matinees that are subsidized. And so we're a gathering place. We're a social gathering place. We're a place to come and see the world through different eyes, through the artistic expressions that happen in various, as you just said, from craft to film to performance. Basically, we're also here to support the academic mission of the college so that our student community, our faculty community have the resources to build our educational programs on and our experiential programs, because we have a series of performing ensembles that reside in the HOP that are, they're led by working artists who happen to teach. And students get to perform here and then in good days when we don't have pandemics and other things keeping us back, all over the world as well, because we tour.
Oh, wow. I hate to ask, but do you ever get to see any of the wonderful lineup of events that you wind up scheduling there?
Well, you know, my challenge is how many I can see in a night. We are 24/7 operation here, and especially as we're welcoming audiences back from the pandemic, we want people to see our faces, those of us who work here, and we want to personally welcome our audience so that people feel comfortable coming back to the HOP, because we don't want anyone to miss the opportunity to gather around so many of these great programs. And we also want to support our artists who are in the Upper Valley and visiting the Upper Valley. So we're on the ground a lot, and I've been known to see a little bit of this and that, a first act of this and the second act of that, in order to cover as much ground as possible.
Well, it's interesting that you say that about seeing as many as you can in an evening or a day. You have something coming up in March called Abenaki Artistry, which I want to come down for. And I immediately looked at the rest of the schedule. There's an opera, a Met opera in HD that day as well. And I think I can do both. And what a great day that would be to come to the HOP and take in two incredibly different cultural events.
Yeah. Well, you know, before I arrived here at the Hopkins Center, I was a festival director. And to me, every day at the HOP is a festival, because it's often that we have these multiple events scheduled in a way that you can experience a broad range of things. For example, in March also, there's a day when you can come and see Small Island Big Song, and this is a collection of Asian Pacific Islanders who've come together in a concert that tells the story of their traditions. And then and that's in the afternoon on the 15th, and then in the evening you can come and spend an evening with Nicole Hannah-Jones and take a deep dive on her project 1619. So you can't, I don't think you can have a more varied day. You know, that's the thing. The diversity is so exciting as well.
You can see why I want to move into the HOP now, don't you?
Yes.
How do you think a student's time in college is enhanced or expanded by what you're able to present to them at the HOP?
Well, I would say there are many ways, but I would say the two dominant ones that surface in my heart today have to do with the sense of being able to sit shoulder to shoulder in a room to experience something that you've never experienced before, the awe of being live with something happening in front of you, and being able to talk about it with friends and colleagues and faculty members and be part of a community that then takes it back and learns from it. That live experience, we've missed it so much. The HOP was one of the first to pivot to online programming. We launched a online platform called HOP at Home, but there's nothing like being in a room together. So it's that being in place together that I think is really so valuable. But the other piece is that, you know, you may have seen recently Dartmouth College is embracing a need blind application process for international students. So our community is increasingly diverse. And for us to be able to know each other and live together in harmony in a world, it's wonderful to be able to see things from all around the world that enlighten our perspectives of the world around us and others and the stories of their being. So that, if more than anything, I hear we are in the morning when we're announcing such sadness in Europe. Yeah. And, you know, the first thing I thought was, well, you know, we've got a lot of diversity on our program, and let's keep our hearts and minds open. And I think that will be really important for our students. You know, the arts are, we teach the arts here, but we also teach humanity here through the arts. Let us all know what it's like to be a fellow human being through what we see on our stages.
And Mary Lou, I mean, anyone, you know, who, especially early days of the pandemic, when we all felt so isolated and confused, it was the arts that kind of united us through streaming and opened our lives again to what was out there. So, you know, it is kind of that piece that I think we learned more than anything was so important to us as the pandemic began and lingered.
Yeah, no, it's really true. And in fact, we were so grateful that we were able to reach out around the world through our streamed our stream programs. We had, you know, we have alumni all over the world. We have many people who've lived in the Upper Valley and moved away and kind of missed us. And through these stream programs, we were able to be together again. And we are continuing some of our online programming for those who might not feel comfortable coming into the hall. There are some stream programs that will be coming up. There'll be some individual films that are not accessible live. So we want to keep that community together and just remind people that the HOP is here, yes, but it's also, you know, wherever you can access it. So we've learned a lot. We've all learned a lot during this time.
Let's talk about some events coming up. It seems like Dartmouth Idol only started yesterday, but this is year 15. Next month you have a special event planned. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it is 15 years, a pretty amazing fact. And when you think about all of the people that were touched during those 15 years, all of the semifinalists and the finalists and the judges and all of that, we felt like this year it was time for a celebration, even more than a usual competition. So I think there's plenty of sparkle planned for our Crystal anniversary, and we're just looking forward to bringing some folks together that haven't been together for a while. So plenty of surprises, but it is a celebration of the 15 years. And quite honestly, you know, COVID has had a huge impact on our ability to gather and rehearse. You know, there have been performances where, you know, not everybody's been on stage until the actual performance because of various, you know, Omicron impacts. Yeah. So it's just a moment to come together and just celebrate the 15 years. So we're really looking forward to that.
Another innovative idea is Big Move. Tell us about that. What is Big Move?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've been doing here at the HOP is to expand our notion of where the arts belong by really thinking about how the arts intersect with our daily lives. So over the summer, we welcomed two choreographers that were inspired by our local environment, and Emily Coates did a collaboration with a faculty member in astronomy that was about literally dancing with the stars outside of our observatory on a hill. And Manu Fuan and collaborated with our arborist and did some choreographic installations in the trees. But what we're also doing is thinking about how movement connects to just our daily lives. And so actually when we have The Day here, which is an amazing production featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning composers' work, David Lang and Maya Beiser, who's an internationally acclaimed cellist, and the amazing Wendy Whalen dancing. Wendy is a former ballet dancer from the New York City Opera, City Ballet, and also its associate artistic director. She's going to be doing some conversations and interventions about movement and aging and how movement helps you deal with aging. So it's those kinds of applications that we're looking for in dance that we're calling the big move. And but there are plenty of other intersections also with the other disciplines, just trying to illuminate the role of the arts beyond the stage.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We got Fred joining us from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. You know, if you look at humans, humans forever just love to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reason why I think that entertainers make probably the most money in any society. You look at football players, they have gigantic stadiums to give them the economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball is the same way. And then we have television now, we have movies. Movies give entertainers the economies of scale. And radio even gives people economies of scale. And one of the most highly paid entertainers in our lifetime was Rush Limbaugh. Mm-hmm. And he said, the reason why I'm so highly paid is because I'm a political entertainer and people like to listen to me. And he was getting something like 20 million people listeners. I think it was 20 million a week that would listen for at least 15 minutes a day. And of course, that gave him tremendous economies of scale, and he made a ton of money.
Yeah, Fred, thanks for that point. You know, to Fred's point, Mary Lou, the idea of being entertained is one thing, but at the hop, the idea of being entertained and that shared experience, sitting, you know, in the arena, not, you know, sitting by yourself listening, you know, to the radio or, you know, when it's streamed, but that shared experience adds, for some reason, just adds to that wonderful live performance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are plenty of ways for us to consume culture and entertainment, as the caller had said, and in large volume. But it's the intimacy and the directness of the message at the hop, the social engagement that comes along with it, I think that's what sets us apart. And it's very hard to have economy of scale in that environment. So we recognize that when we have a community that can support a performing arts center like this, we're really, really lucky, because it doesn't happen just at the box office or through advertising or some of the other more commercial mechanisms. But the power is of being together is so deep and so needed in a time when we're all still walking around with our masks on and somewhat isolated. So it's more valued than ever, in my view.
Yeah. What's going on there with the renovation and expansion of the hop?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that this old girl was the precursor to Lincoln Center, and
right,
like many of us who are vintage mid-20th century, you know, we need a little help now and again, right?
Right.
So the hop has actually been serving this community for 60 years, and so lots of change. First, you know, its value to this community as a gathering place for all is really advancing our design thinking around what we're doing at the hop. So lots more accessible spaces, lots more accessible entrances, lots more of opportunities for us to come together in warm and welcoming environments. The other thing that's really important to recognize is that technologies and the way people make art and consume art has changed radically since the mid-20th century. We've been talking about that throughout. So the design is being driven by the commitment to continue to bring people together, but to do it in a way that allows it to project out into the world and to welcome as many people as possible. So, you know, artists are no longer just making art for a stage or for a film that is consumed. There's a lot more participatory kinds of activities around making art. You know, artists are interested in lots of different forms. So the flexibility to be able to and adaptability to be able to embrace that is going to be part of the new hop renovation and expansion. And I have to say, the other thing that's really exciting is that this is all part of the college's master plan to actually expand the relationship between the HOP and the Hood Museum and our academic departments in the Black Family Visual Arts Center and really create an even larger destination arts district. So this next phase of construction around the HOP really springboard an even bigger and more dynamic and diverse artistic destination for us all.
We have about a minute left, Mary Lou. How can people support the HOP?
Well, I think the first thing you might want to do is check us out at our website, which is hop.dartmouth.edu. And I think one of the great ways to support the HOP is to be a member. You know, memberships at the HOP allow us to make our programs as accessible as possible, subsidize tickets, and also offer free programming and school matinees and other community-based work. So we really value our members, and we try to thank our members with events and seating privileges and some discounts. So I think that's a great way in. And, you know, just come.
Yeah.
Tell people to come. That's the other best way. And so we really appreciate anything and everything that anybody in the community can do to keep us going.
Mary Lou Oleski is the director of the Hopkins Center for the Arts at Dartmouth. And to keep up on all the developments at the HOP, go to hop.dartmouth.edu. Mary Lou, it's been wonderful having you on the show this morning. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me, Rick.
All right. Have a great day. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll return to discuss the avian flu. And coming up today on WDEV, we've got the afternoon news service at 4 with Brady Farkas, the Brady Farkas show after that, up to 6:45, more high school basketball on the way this evening. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. With all due respect to our next guests, I hope that you'll not need a bit of the information they're about to impart. But forewarned is forearmed. Avian flu has been detected in North America, and it's best to know about what that means, how to detect it, what to do in case it is found here in Vermont. Joining us now to provide the information on the avian flu is Vermont State Veterinarian Dr. Kristen Haas. Dr. Haas, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I believe my colleague, Dr. Kate Levine, is with us as well.
Perhaps. We do. Dr. Caitlin Levine is the Assistant State Veterinarian. Dr. Levine, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests about avian influenza, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dr. Haas, what exactly is highly pathogenic avian influenza that we're concerned about right now?
Yes, well, it's something that we're happy to be able to give people, your listeners, some tips about today and share some information on it with your listeners. Avian influenza, highly pathogenic avian influenza, is a flu virus that affects birds of many types. It is commonly found in wild birds, migratory birds, water birds, ducks, etc. But the interesting thing is that it often doesn't cause them to become sick. So they can carry it in the environment, but they manage it pretty well. In instances where the disease spreads over into domestic birds, poultry, chickens, and other species, turkeys, for example, then we can see some really sick birds, high death rates, pretty severe illness. It's a very contagious type of virus, and it causes pretty severe illness in our domestic poultry and other species. Mm.
And is it something that we see yearly, like the flu that we all get vaccinated against?
It is. That's a great question. Yes, it is continually circulating again out in the wild bird population. There are different strains that crop up each year. As you might imagine, the wild birds do not respect, you know, state geopolitical boundaries, and so they are flying all over the country in different flyways, and these viruses can persist in those environments. And we were told, we were given the heads up by our epidemiology colleagues, federal colleagues, this past fall, that the environmental conditions were right and the amount of virus circulating in these wild birds seemed to be, on this given year, much greater than what it had been in years past. So they gave us the heads up that we should be on the lookout and kind of bolster our response plans and so on and so forth for the possibility that this virus could infect domestic birds. So that wild bird surveillance that is ongoing really does provide a wonderful early warning system for the a possible domestic bird introduction. And we have our state and federal wildlife colleagues to thank for that ongoing surveillance.
Dr. Levine, with the flu passed by humans, we worry about it through the winter months. What about the avian flu? Same time period of concern?
It does seem to be more prevalent in the winter and into spring. In these parts, the migratory season has a lot to do with it. All respiratory conditions seem to benefit from being indoors, decreased ventilation, increased contact. And then the wild birds who are migrating through in the early, early parts of spring, after mixing, there's big intermixing in different populations in the wintering grounds and in the summering grounds. So spring, fall, when there's the migratory patterns is when it gets the new wave, the new strain gets introduced into the environment. And then over the winter with everyone being in closer contact, and by everyone, I mean our birds as well as our people, are huddled closer together this time of year, and so it's more likely to spread and amplify.
Where has it been detected so far in the continent?
The closest it's come is there's been a detection in domestic birds off the coast, on the coast of Maine. A wild duck was found with it as close as New Hampshire, but Maine is the closest domestic jump that we've found. It's been also seen in New York, Delaware, Virginia, and they're having a pretty difficult time with it right now in Indiana and Kentucky.
Dr. Haas, how does this flu get introduced and then transmitted from one bird to another?
It can be introduced in a number of ways, and this is where I think we as human beings and as bird owners, you know, can play a huge role in trying to prevent that, that introduction. But it can be spread from wild birds to domestic birds either directly through direct contact between those different species, or what's more likely and what happens more often is that it's spread indirectly, meaning that our domestic chickens, turkeys, guinea fowl, et cetera, come into contact with feces or other, you know, excrements from wild birds, or they share water sources on a property and sort of indirectly commingle that way. We also can see it spread from what we call mechanical spread. So there can be spread from shared equipment and people's boots and shoes and carrying it from one place to another. So it's pretty good at spreading. It can also spread and has been shown in prior outbreaks to spread from farm to farm or domestic poultry group to domestic poultry group by aerosolization. So there can be the wind that carries, you know, virus particles from place to place.
So, Dr. Levine, what can we do to mitigate, to reduce the risk of avian flu being passed, being spread among poultry flocks?
The biggest thing is to make sure you're not one of those mechanical spreaders. The wind is going to do what it's going to do. And as Dr. Haas mentioned, you can't tell a duck where a state border is, but you can minimize the number of visitors you have to your farm, minimize the number of people who are interacting with your birds because you don't know what they've encountered. Having dedicated boots, coveralls, coats, so that typical just PPE can be as simple as a pair of boots that you only wear in and out of your flock and you clean them regularly. And to make sure that you are cleaning and disinfecting everything that you introduce into the barn, especially if you're, you know, borrowing equipment. Now is not the time to do that, but if you have to bring in something new, make sure it's being cleaned really well before you're introducing it to your flock. Mm.
Dr. Haas, are only larger domestic flocks really at risk of getting this flu?
I am so glad you asked that question because that is one of the points that we want to very emphatically stress, and that is that for better or worse, this virus does not discriminate between flock sizes. It doesn't discriminate between uses of various birds, whether they are, you know, pets or kept for egg production or meat production. So the preventative measures that Dr. Levine just mentioned, we really want to encourage every single human being in Vermont that owns one or more types of poultry or domestic birds, to domestic poultry specifically, to take those measures and adhere to them, because we see this in bird flock sizes of all sizes.
Mm. And Dr. Levine, is there much of a risk to humans? And if so, you know, what would be the effect?
This strain hasn't been found to have any human infections at this time. If it was to make the jump, you'd really want to speak to our colleagues over in human health. It can present as simply as just the flu. But right now, there have been no cases of this strain of HPAI seen in humans.
So it
in America.
So people don't have to mask up or take other steps when interacting with these birds.
It's always a good idea to make sure you're washing your hands and you're minimizing that kind of contact when it comes to birds. The avian influenza isn't the only thing that birds have with them. Salmonella is always a really big concern, right, in live birds, as well as a food safety concern. So while there's not an increased risk at this time of this virus causing disease, it's a good idea to maintain some distance. Don't be cuddling with your birds. Make sure you're washing your hands really well after any time that you're interacting with them.
So social distancing and hand washing, we should have that down pretty well by now, Dr. Levine.
Some very similar practices, yes.
All right, good. And let's go to Bristol first to talk to Norm. Hi, Norm. Go right ahead.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
I've been listening to your commentary with the two doctors about the avian flu.
Yep.
I sometimes go out and park by fields and observe wild turkeys. And I was wondering, since I haven't seen as many in the last couple of years, if this flu could have an effect on wild birds.
Hmm. Norm, great question. Dr. Levine, Norm has seen, you know, less wild turkeys, wondering if it has had an effect on those particular wild birds.
Yes, that's a really good question, and one we asked ourselves early in this process. What it amounts to is, while turkeys can be affected by it, turkeys of any kind, are affected by avian influenza, there's not been demonstrated to be a population-wide significant impact from this virus. It doesn't have much effect in songbirds things like woodpeckers, but it can have an effect on raptors or birds of prey. And in our turkeys, while they could get it and probably do, it doesn't have a significant impact on their population.
All right. Dr. Haas, human flu, you know, we tend to be able to detect it in our cells. And not to be facetious, but I'm guessing these birds aren't going around sneezing and going through a lot of boxes of tissues. How does one detect avian flu in their flock?
Right. So the way that sometimes the way that it is detected, because this is such a contagious virus, is that you can have normal appearing birds one day or 2 days prior, and then they can be extremely sick and dying or already passed away, you know, in a very short period. So sometimes it's sudden death. For those birds that where you are able to observe a period of illness associated with this, then it often is respiratory signs. So you might see some snicking or sneezing, some nasal discharge, some eye discharge, swollen combs and wattles, lethargy, decreased egg production. They look and act like really, just really sick birds, a bad flu, basically, yes.
And Dr. Levine, upon detecting or suspecting the presence of avian flu, what should owners of a poultry flock do?
Call us. right now we're fielding lots of questions about sick birds across the state, and we are evaluating each of the cases and the presentations to determine if this warrants coming out and testing. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. It really depends on the presentation and the timing of what's going on. But we don't expect everybody to know the nuances of those cases. So if you're concerned about any sickness in your barn, if you've had more deaths than usual in your flock, please either call us at the state at 802-828-2421, or the USDA has a toll-free number that's available, which is 1-866-536-7593. But if you want to keep it local, keep it Vermont, just call our offices. We're here to talk you through what you're seeing and determine if further steps are needed.
All right, the local number again, 802-828-2421. Let's now go to Montpelier. Stephen, you're up next. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Rick. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. I just wanted to say that I'm just back from Boulder, Colorado, and we hear you out there perfectly.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Anyway, I just have a quick story, not related to the avian flu, but related to birds. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I was birding with Roger Torrey Peterson at the Hammonasset State Park in Connecticut. And we got up early, three of us got up early one morning and went birding. Mm-hmm. And we came back about 7:30 and went to Roger's tent. And we said, Roger, we've just gotten 32 birds. And Roger was still in his tent. He said, that's wonderful. I've just gotten 74 and I haven't gotten out of my tent.
Just on the calls he heard, the yes. Birds? Interesting. All right, Stephen, thanks for that great bird story and birding. And we'll do more shows on birding coming up. But Kristen Haas, getting back to avian flu, when was the last time we've had an outbreak of avian flu, or have we, here in Vermont?
Knock on wood, we have not had issues in the past here in Vermont and do not yet have detections in Vermont associated with the current outbreak. The last time that the U.S. was significantly impacted by these high pathogenic strains of avian influenza was back in the mid-2010s, so 2015 thereabouts, mm-hmm. and states in the West and Midwest were impacted. And that was a very significant outbreak that resulted in the loss of a measurable percentage of our nation's broilers and turkeys and egg layers. So it was quite significant, and we were fortunate to escape that and hope with people's diligence and best practices that we can do the same here.
Yeah. Dr. Levine, what are and how are veterinarians in Vermont being instructed about the eventuality of an avian flu outbreak here?
They're getting very similar messages that we're asking the public. Be on the lookout for these signs. Call us if they're seeing things consistent with what they suspect might be HPAI. Because this is considered a foreign animal disease, the testing has to be done in a very regulated manner and by a specifically trained team of people. And so veterinarians are asked to be familiar with the signs and symptoms of HPAI and to report anything to us that's suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Haas, after COVID and the various variants, is there a great likelihood that avian flu will reach Vermont eventually?
Cool. That's a tough question. I think I would answer it by saying that it is reasonable to expect that we have wild birds flying in our airways over Vermont that are carrying the virus. So while that is the case, we are certainly hopeful to keep it out of the domestic population, and that's where, again, for individual bird owners can do a great job and help us help them accomplish that task. Mm-hmm. So fingers crossed, and please, if everybody does their part, we will improve our odds of keeping it out of our domestic flocks here.
Dr. Levine, are there certain species more likely to contract this flu than others, you know, of domestic fowl?
That's a really good question. I know that chickens and turkeys are the ones we see it most represented in. Mm-hmm. Turkeys have a higher rate of mortality than chickens do, but other poultry species have been known to contract it, peafowl, ratite, so things like emus. So any of our domestic birds can be at risk. The category that's at the biggest risk is called gallinaceous birds, which are our the category of birds, the family of birds that chickens and turkeys and peafowl fall into.
Gotcha. And Dr. Haas, do hunters who hunt wildfowl have to be cognizant of what we've been discussing this morning?
They do, and we have partnered already with our Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife colleagues on messaging, and I am aware that the Department of Fish and Wildlife will be getting out some more targeted messaging to hunters that would be specific to that sector. But in general, yes, anyone who has any interaction with wild birds or domestic poultry should be aware of this disease and take the precautions that would be appropriate. And I would say, for hunters, what I would encourage people to do would be to visit the Department of Fish and Wildlife's website, and also people can refer to the joint press release that our departments issued, because there are some really great tips referenced there for the hunters in Vermont and what they should be doing if they come into contact with any dead birds, and then as they are going through the process of dressing, you know, birds that they are hunting.
Yeah. Dr. Kristen Haas is Vermont State Veterinarian, and Dr. Caitlin Levine is Vermont's Assistant State Veterinarian. To learn more about avian influenza, you can visit agriculture.vermont.gov. And if you have questions, again, the numbers to call 802-828-2421 or 866-536-7593. Drs. Haas and Levine, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Very much.
All right, take care.
Opportunity, and stay safe, everybody.
All right, excellent advice. We're going to take a break for CBS News and then return to learn about Twincraft Skincare. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's a full-blown three-hour version of The Getaway with the gregarious host, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Every once in a while, this company that quietly goes about making great products here in Vermont pops up on my radar. Most recently, it was last week when I had Angela Arsenault of the Williston Joy Brigade on the show. And as they try to make students and staff, school staff in Williston feel appreciated in the midst of this two-year pandemic, they received a wonderful contribution from this company to put together gift packs of soap and skincare products. The recipients were blown away. It's time we got to know more about this company that has facilities in Winooski and Essex. Joining me now is Michelle Ash, the Vice President of Leadership and Organizational Development for Twin Craft Skincare. Michelle, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, if you've got a question for Michelle about Twin Craft, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Michelle, how and when was Twin Craft started?
Twin Craft was started in Montreal in 1972. By my father-in-law and his identical twin brother, which is why it's called Twin Craft.
Oh, okay. And did they have a background in soaps and skincare?
No, it's an interesting story, Rick. They were actually ahead of their time. They were in plastics, and they were actually doing bottled water. They were making plastic bottles and got into bottled water, and they decided to sell the company. And when they did, Avon, who was one of their customers, said to them, hey, if you're interested in making bar soap for us, we'll give you some bar soap lines to get you started, and you can make soap for us. And that's how they got started.
Wow. And how did they go from Montreal to Vermont?
Sure. Well, then they were selling mostly into the United States, and that was pre-NAFTA. So because of the taxes, it didn't really make sense to keep shipping product over the border. So they looked over the border and actually looked at Plattsburgh and Winooski as options for a bar soap factory, and fortunately chose Winooski.
Oh, I love it. What types?
And then eventually it made sense to just close the Montreal operation and operate exclusively out of Vermont.
Nice. What types of products does Twin Craft make here in Vermont now?
Sure. So everything we do is in the specialty market, because in order to be a manufacturer in Vermont, we can't be the lowest commodity manufacturer in the country. Our geographic location is not conducive to it. Mm-hmm. You know, if we wanted to maximize and be in the commodity business, we'd have to relocate. So we're only specialty, and in Winooski, we make high-end bar soap for brands, and in Essex, we have two facilities where we make skincare.
And explain specialty market to people, because as opposed to commodity market.
Sure. Well, if you think about going to the grocery store and you see, you know, Dove, Irish Spring, those are really, really commodity bars. We manufacture for brands like Native, Beauty Counter, Whole Foods, Glossier. We also just started a bar soap program for Bath and Body Works. So when we're making for brands, we're making for sort of the higher end bar soap and skincare brands.
Twin Craft still family owned?
Still family owned. So actually, it's an interesting story, because I don't know if you know, but we did sell the company in 2006. And then we bought it back in 2011. And we bought it back and got to see what happens when you sell a family business. You know, the culture deteriorated. We started getting into high-volume, low-margin business, which meant we couldn't pay well, et cetera, et cetera. And we bought it back, and we are really fortunate in that we've got a son. Our son, David, loves the business. Has been working in the business the past 5 years, and we have no plans of selling. We have plans
fantastic.
Of keeping it a family business.
It is great to hear that it's back in the family. What is the culture, you know, that you talked about that, you know, had kind of slipped away and, you know, has been kind of re-embraced in these last the last decade?
Sure. You know, it's I've been doing a lot of research on just what is the magic, because what we're told by employees is there's magic here. And I know it's true because we've been able to, since the pandemic, we've hired 250 people at Twin Craft.
Wow.
And in talking directly to employees, aside from, you know, you have to pay well, so we pay well, we have excellent benefits, we have some other things that I can talk about in a bit, but I think the real magic is people coming to work and feeling like they are making a contribution and that their thoughts matter, their ideas matter. Because we're specialty, this is not like you don't come and you're just a cog in a wheel. Like, we need people to come and co-create with us. And we consider ourselves artisanal manufacturers.
Mm.
So, and then the other piece is, you know, when you sort of get the right people on the bus, people that care about each other, people that want to contribute in meaningful ways, the energy just kind of takes off from there. And because we're in a high growth mode, there's opportunities for people to grow and expand, which is the other thing that folks have mentioned.
Do you mind telling us how big the company is now, today?
Sure. We're 350 employees, and we're running about an $80 million company.
Mm. That is a substantial business here in Vermont, especially in two towns, Winooski and Essex. So you really have quite an impact on those communities.
Yeah, and that was part of the reason that, you know, when my husband and I said, you know, do we want to sell the business? Because the phone just does not stop ringing. There's a lot of money out there, and people want to buy businesses like Twin Craft.
Right.
We could do that. But we've become such a part of the fabric of the community, we just weren't interested. And when we had a son who said, you know what, I love the business, and, you know, we're gonna keep it here.
Nice. Now, Michelle, I would imagine that to remain kind of ahead and at the forefront of a specialty market business like this, you have to continuously be developing new products for clients. So how do you go about doing that?
You're right on, Rick. Well, we have a really sort of state-of-the-art, sophisticated lab, a lot of talented formulators. We also have a marketing team that pays attention to trends. And then really most importantly, you know, if some people say they partner with their customers, the only way that we succeed and really grow is to truly partner with the brands we work with. So we bring new ideas to them. We'll co-create formulas with them. And then, you know, we deliver. Our production folks are top-notch.
Mm. Now, you talk about specialty products and yes. and even kind of luxury products. So in soap and in skincare, what makes them a higher grade product than the mass produced soaps that we find on store shelves?
Yeah. It's all about, it's just like food. It's all about the ingredients. Hmm. We're really, our niche is natural. So we're in the natural space. We use high quality ingredients, and with the whole movement towards sustainability, we have machines that can run all kinds of sustainable packaging. So the sort of the high-end brands want high-quality ingredients. They want sustainable packaging, and they want flexibility in how we manufacture. That's really what it's about.
Approximately how many companies do you produce for?
Around 200 brands.
Wow. I want to focus again a little bit on the high quality rather than high quantity of materials, of products you make, Michelle, and why this makes more sense for companies like yours in Vermont. I'm thinking also of Darn Tough and other Vermont companies. Explain why that should be the focus of companies that are located here.
Well, just as far as logistics, we're not located in a central part of the country. So when we manufacture for brands, transportation is more expensive for them to get the product to their distribution center. That's one piece. They've got to come to Twin Craft because there's a value add. The other piece is, you know, as far as doing business in Twin Craft, labor costs are higher here. So in order to be able to meet those costs, we've got to sell products at higher margins. So if we wanted to go into that commodity space, we would move someplace down south. We might move to the Midwest, and then it would make more sense. But for companies, there's a niche here in Vermont. There's a manufacturing niche. You just have to find that niche.
Interesting. Now, I love my beautifully scented soaps, but I'd be pretty hard-pressed to explain how soap becomes soap. So can you give us a quick tutorial?
Absolutely. Well, we buy our soap base, which comes in the form of soap noodles, so little pellets. We buy those from plantations in Malaysia and Indonesia. They're from palm oil, mostly. Some of it has coconut oil. So it's really an equatorial product, and we buy thousands and thousands of super sacks of soap noodles. And really, it's like making cookies. So if you were to come to our plant, you would watch our batch makers follow a recipe, which is put the soap noodles in, add the fragrance, add any colorants, add any additives like shea butter or any type of exfoliant, any type of extra oils. Literally stir it up. And then I don't know if you've ever heard triple milled soap. What that means is it's just put through these screens and screws to homogenize the ingredients. And then we press out what's called a slug. We press it into bars. And then we have so many different types of packaging options. And then the soap will get packaged whatever to according to whatever the brand wants.
And will this does it spend a lot of time drying or being oven dried? How does it become kind of a bar of soap?
It comes out some of our brands, and this is this is the big key, flexibility. This is what we're told by our customers. We are so flexible, which is why we need really we train up and we have a lot of good talent. The bar soap can go right into a box immediately in line, or it gets trayed and it sits for about 2 to 3 days just to allow some of the moisture content to be released if it's got to go into tighter packaging. If the packaging needs to be tighter, we just want to make sure that the bars have cured, but not for very long.
Gotcha. And what are some of the more interesting or intricate soaps that you've made there?
Well, we were the first to come up with what's called a noodle bar. And that's where you have, let's say the bar is white, you'll have chunks of colors throughout that bar. We call it our chunky noodle bar. We also do bars that have stripes through them. Oh my goodness, we do so many innovative pieces. And, you know, I'll tell you an interesting story. We've had the big guys, you know, Colgate, Procter & Gamble, come to Little Twin Craft to pay us for our innovation.
Wow.
And what's always amazing to me is you've got these companies that have access to an incredible amount of money compared to us, but they have so many, they're, you know, layers of bureaucracy and ways of doing business that they don't necessarily go outside the box and try things, and we do. So it's, you know, with far less resources, we're far more creative. You know, it's that sort of entrepreneurial mentality.
What a badge of honor that is. All right, I want to shift to skincare products, and I would imagine this is similar but much different than making soaps, correct?
Yes. What's similar is it's the same customer base, but nothing else about it is similar. The equipment is far more sophisticated. We have become expert in making natural deodorant products, which is the rage right now. The Yeah, the equipment is a lot more sophisticated.
And are these in different plants? Do you have different development departments for each of, for the soaps and for the skincare?
We have a skincare lab and we have a bar soap lab. Mm. Yes. But the labs are both located in Winooski, and the two production facilities are located in Essex.
Gotcha. Now, I just always think, skincare, lotions, but you really have developed a number of different products. Tell us about them.
Sure. Let's see. Lotions, we make face washes. We make serums. We do sunscreen. All sorts of balms. Really anything that one puts on their skin.
You better explain serums to me. I'm not sure I take care of my skin well enough to know all of these products, but what is a serum?
Sure. Rick, I think I need to send you some skincare products to improve your regime here.
Thank you.
A serum is what you put on. You wash your face, and then you put a serum on, and then you put your lotion on. So a serum is much thinner, and usually it carries properties that you can't find in a lotion, like it might have your vitamin C, different vitamins in it, different anti-aging and botanicals in it.
All right. Now I'll add that to my list. I can't avoid asking you about something I saw on your website called, and I'll do my best to pronounce it correctly, the Magic Muro Muro Shambar. What is this?
Well, there's a whole movement, as you're well aware of, to try to eliminate plastics.
Right.
So when you can use a bar soap for a shampoo and conditioner, you don't have the plastic bottles. So they become super popular, and we've worked, and yet they can be stripping of the hair. So we have been working on for a while a shampoo and conditioner bar that, not just men with really short hair, but women will want to use in the shower. And that's what that is.
Oh, that's brilliant. You also have innovative stuff going on, like the use of CBD, snow ear mushroom, and turmeric. What else should we be looking for that you're producing for your clients?
What else should we be looking for? We are always researching whatever the hottest product is. And I think, the newest both to dietary and skincare and the rage are different mushroom extracts. It's interesting. If you follow the vitamin market, skincare is usually right there following.
Oh, interesting. I was wondering, when one of your researchers walks in and says snow ear mushroom, do you all roll your eyes or do you all say, oh, brilliant. Let's go. What can we do with that? What are the properties?
It's the latter. We say, what are the properties? And we'll share it with our customers. Alternatively, our customers will come to us with some cool things that they want to do. So it's really a process of co-creating often. We'll bring new ideas, and then we'll build from there with them. Or they'll come and say, hey, we want to try this. What do you think? And we'll say, let's try it. We're really partner with them.
That's great. You said that you added 250 jobs since the pandemic. How are your staffing needs right now?
Our staffing needs are the biggest it's the biggest limiter to growth. Is finding enough employees. It's been fascinating, and it's as a result of the pandemic, but it's been amazing for us to watch. 50% of our new hires come from employee referrals, which, for us says a lot.
Sure does.
That means that if somebody wants to work there and they're going to refer somebody. But we, for the first time, have had folks come from different industries. We've had folks come from education. We have a phys ed teacher from Shelburne that started here, banking, food service, retail. And I think folks didn't think about manufacturing as a really viable career, and now they're seeing that that is the case. There is a lot of room for growth. In production, we work a four-day work week, and people love that. So we're seeing a lot of folks come from other industries, and we're not a big manufacturing state. If we get the right people in, we will train them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've become known for that, too. So we take people from other industries and say, okay, if you are hardworking and want to learn, we'll teach you.
Michelle, who would enjoy working at Twin Craft?
If we're looking in production, I think someone who likes working with their hands, likes working as a team, as a member of a team, somebody who, you know, it's interesting. We're always looking for good mechanics.
Hmm.
And I always say it's really someone grew up on a farm.
Yeah.
Fixing farm equipment.
Yep.
Come see us. We have mechanics that, you know, just sort of grew up fixing stuff.
Right.
And they come and we can train them.
Yeah.
But I think really folks that want to grow, want to work with their hands, and want to learn something new. We have somebody who used to be a physical therapist. You know, it's just we really have a diverse group of people.
Wow. And very quickly, how would someone find out about openings and applying?
They'd go to our webpage, at our careers page. And I would encourage folks, if there's not an opening for something that looks interesting, if you're interested in the company, just get in touch with us.
Hmm.
Because we've even had folks that come to say, I don't know where I'd fit, but it sounds interesting. And we've hired them.
Love it.
And we've moved them around so they can find what they really like.
Oh, interesting.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We continue to celebrate WDEV's 90th anniversary. As part of that, I have been on the road broadcasting from various towns around the state. The next stop will be at the Elmore General Store next Thursday. And we're also rolling out the red carpet in our 90th year, speaking to many WDEV All-Stars. This morning, I've got the man who hosted this show for a few years, in between the many positions he's held when the call has gone out for someone who could get things running ship-shape. Joining me here in the studio is Mike Smith. Mike, great to have you on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Rick. I really enjoy it.
I'm glad you came in. It's great to see you again. Listeners, if you'd like to speak with Mike or ask him a question, give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I should have made you bring in your resume because it's got to be one of the most impressive of anyone in the state. When you headed off to UVM, did you ever expect to have some of the jobs that you've held through all the years?
No, I didn't. And, you know, the story before UVM was one that would never lead you to believe that, because I was not the greatest high school student in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I couldn't get into college my first try because of my grades. And luckily, I made a wise decision to enlist in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
and made a wiser decision to try out for SEAL Team. And eventually, that's put me on to the road that I'm on, that I eventually went on, and then came back to Vermont, went to UVM, was successful there, and then the rest is history.
We got to talk about that being a Navy SEAL. What was that like?
It was one of the most fantastic experiences I've ever had. Now, with that said, the training was fairly harsh and fairly difficult in terms of what you did. I often say this, the coldest winter I ever spent was in San Diego, California. And people go, well, you're a Vermonter. What do you mean? What are you talking about?
And San Diego is supposed to have the most perfect weather of anywhere on Earth.
And it does, except if you're in the water all the time. And in the wintertime in the water, the Pacific is very cold.
Yeah.
And when you're going through SEAL Team training, you are always in the water, and you are always cold.
You're a seal, man.
Yeah. So that was fun. But I learned a lot in SEAL Team. I went to underwater demolition after BUDS, which is called Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Team Training, and that's what people see, you know, the grueling aspects of the SEAL training is in that aspect. It's in Coronado, California nowadays. And in my day, you were assigned a UDT team after an underwater demolition team. And then you went to SEAL team from underwater demolition team. And when I arrived at SEAL team, I was like young with all these Vietnam veterans that have, you know, had multiple tours to Vietnam. Oh. I will tell you this. They were as welcoming of a group as I've ever seen. And they taught me a lot. They taught me about leadership. They taught me about work. They taught me about ethics. And that stayed with me the whole way.
Boy, after that, I would imagine a big final at UVM seemed kind of a piece of cake, right?
Yeah, well, you have to put things in perspective. You always put pressure on yourself
no matter what,
whether you're in SEAL team or whether you're taking a final. But it was, you know, I often look back and say, you know, was this as tough as what I've been through? And, of course, the answer was always no.
Mm, wow. Now, before you joined Governor Douglas's administration, what were some of the jobs that you had after you graduated from UVM?
Well, I was town manager of Hardwick. For those don't remember that, I also went down to Boston for a little while and worked in a consulting firm that was affiliated with the Massachusetts Municipal Association because of my local government sort of background. I came back. I was deputy treasurer under Jim Douglas and then went into the captive insurance business as a chief operating officer with a local management firm here in Vermont, because Vermont is very well known in the captive industry, the captive insurance industry.
And explain to people what that is, because this is, again, I just had Twincraft on, a company that not many people hear of because of the way that, you know, they produce for other companies. But the captive insurance industry in Vermont is a money spinner that a lot of people don't really realize.
Right. It's huge in Vermont.
And, yeah.
And where it becomes huge is that many companies will form their own insurance company so that they are cutting down on the overhead of, you know, going out and getting insurance through a regular insurance company. You have to be a fairly large or middle-sized company in order to do that because you're taking your own risk in your own hands. But what you do is form your own insurance company. You domicile in Vermont because it's to your advantage to domicile in Vermont. And then you hire because you have to if you're domiciled in Vermont, a management firm to run your company, your insurance company, and that's what we did.
Yeah, incredible that we have that here. I know you served as a state rep for a term, but what did you think, you know, when Governor Douglas called you and said, I want you to be part of my administration?
Well, it was funny because when I left being his deputy state treasurer, Governor Douglas was state treasurer at the time, I said, well, I'm never going to come back to state government. and then I got the call. When you get a call from a governor or a governor-elect, you don't say no.
Right.
You just say, where do you want me, and what should we do? And that was with Governor Douglas. He called me and asked me if I could be Secretary of Administration. And as many people know, that is a position that runs the operations of state government and particularly the budget for state government. So that was a very interesting time. And then, of course, I'll probably jump ahead here. I went over to be Secretary of Human Services under Governor Douglas,
right,
and then came back to be Secretary of Administration. And then when I left state government, again, I said, well, I've done my time, and I'll see you later.
Yeah, but Governor Scott brought you back. You were in human services again. What are the biggest challenges of that position? That can't be an easy one.
It is not.
I mean, for a Navy SEAL, yeah.
I will tell you this. It's probably the most fulfilling job that I've ever had. Hmm. And like you've started to go down the path here from, you know, we've left out a lot, but, you know, sure, state president of Fairpoint and those sort of things.
Well, we'll get to those.
Okay, but but it was probably the most fulfilling job that I ever had. I loved it when I had it the first time. When I came back, I loved it as equally as I did the first time. The reason is you're helping people. You're helping people in need. You're helping people in crisis. And what can be more fulfilling than a job like that?
Yeah.
That's I always came to work every morning as a secretary and said, this is the greatest job that I've ever had.
Yeah. Well, in between, as you mentioned, after you served in the Douglas administration, you seem to be getting the call from a different organization to clean things up. You know, so explain some of those positions that you had in between administrations.
That's right. I did get a call from Fairpoint Communications to ask, and this was like 2 years after, 18 months after I had left the administration. I got a call from Fairpoint Communications to become their state president. I interviewed for the job. If I recall, I interviewed for the job, I got the job, and then they immediately went into bankruptcy, right into that. So that was a challenge to get out of bankruptcy, to get it back onto its feet again. And moving forward, I took on a small job with Burlington College.
Mm-hmm.
That was also in financial trouble, and we were able to stabilize it for a year. I had left. We were able to stabilize it during the time I was there. Eventually, it just, as a lot of small colleges here in New England, eventually it just couldn't compete and was strapped for money and closed. And then I became the president and CEO of Vital, which is a organization that makes sure there's interoperability between medical records here in the state, so that if you have a doctor in Brattleboro and you've been getting seen by a doctor in Burlington, that doctor can see your medical records and not have to sort of create a whole new medical record again.
Right.
And perhaps even create miscommunications or misdiagnosis because of it.
Yeah. Mike, you've got this reputation as a fixer, which I think might be the highest praise that can be given to someone, the person who can come in and get it done. Do you like that term, that reputation?
I don't mind that reputation,
yeah,
but I think what you've got to realize, it just doesn't happen. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into that. I remember the first sort of days of the pandemic, for example. There wasn't any sleep in those first days. And,
right,
and in order to sort of set up the infrastructure to begin to respond to the pandemic back in March of 2020, it was something, and actually it was before that because we started hearing about it from China and some other things. To start to do that just doesn't happen. You have to sort of put the work into it. And I hearken back to sort of my SEAL Team days because before SEAL Team, I always thought, you know, it was luck whether you succeeded or not. You know, it was a lottery of life.
That's right.
You received.
Yeah, I understand that.
And I found out that hard work really depicts of whether you succeed or not. So I don't mind that, because that depicts to me, the word fixer depicts to me a lot of hard work that goes into everything that I've done.
Yeah. I found out after I got out of college, you look in the mirror and I realized, based on my grades, based on the way I went about life, I was a B. I was a B type person. I was happy with a B. And that's the work I wound up doing. That's the friendships and the relationships I developed. And I went back to grad school and decided, for the first time in my life, I'm going to get a 4.0. I didn't even know what that was like or what I was capable of doing it for a semester. And all of a sudden you learn the gears that you have within you that take you beyond being that B person, the person who was struggling in high school yet became the guy everybody in this state has called on to fix things.
Yeah.
So that's you.
And I think I discovered early on, and SEAL Team did it, but I discovered early on that the work, the perseverance, the commitment means a lot to success.
Yeah.
And the lottery idea that I had in high school just doesn't work. You know, you just don't sit there and gold strikes you.
Yeah. I was always told it's not what you know, it's who you know. And that is, it helps to know some people, but you still have to be the person, like you did, do the hard graft and get it done. Now, how did it come about that you took over for this show when Mark Johnson left WDEV?
It was an interesting – I'm trying to recall, but I know that we got in contact with one another, Ken and I, and talked about it. And I said, this will be interesting, because I've been always in my life been on the other side of the microphone. As you know, being on that side, your side of the microphone.
Big difference.
Big difference. A lot of work again in order to make it successful. And you've done, I can see right now looking at your notes, you've done a lot of work in order to make it successful. So I said, it's something I've never done before.
Not any radio at all?
Other than being interviewed.
Yeah.
Not any radio at all.
Wow.
And thought, well, let's give it a shot and let's see how it goes. And it seemed to go well for
me. Did you enjoy hosting the show?
I did. Yeah. I really did. I really enjoyed, and it was the interaction that I would have with the audience. Yeah. I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Even if somebody disagreed with me, I just really liked, the interactions that we had. And there were quite a few people that disagreed with me.
Oh, everybody agrees with me. So it's been the easiest thing ever. Hey, let's go to another Vermont All-Star. We've got Rusty DeWeese with us. Hey, Rusty.
Hey, Rick. Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Hey, yeah. Rusty.
You were talking. I'm enjoying your show, and of course, been on both of your shows, and very prepared, each one of you. And thank you. But one of the four agreements: always do your best, which harkens Mike Smith. The question is, Mike, are you ever going to land in that top position at the Burlington Airport? I wonder.
Oh.
Thank you, and have a good day, you guys.
The next position to be called into to fix things.
Yeah.
Hey, have you thought about this? Is that something?
I have not thought about it. I got to tell you, I'm enjoying, retirement right now.
Yeah.
And this one may stick. I don't know if it will. I'm not making any predictions.
Right.
But this one may stick. I'm at the age, my wife has retired, and, when the winter gets over and I get off the ice, because I've been doing some ice fishing and doing a lot of cross country skiing, I may feel that this is the way that I should do my life. One of the things, Rick, that I said when I was retiring, I have fewer days ahead of me than I have behind me.
Yeah.
And once you realize that, you've got to say, well, you've got to enjoy
them.
Those.
Yeah.
How are you going to spend those? How are you going to enjoy those? And that's an important revelation. I think I've never thought of life like that.
Yeah.
That there is an end to it at some point.
Yeah.
And I've just never thought of it that
way. And you've also moved to a remote part of Vermont so that it makes it more difficult for you to get to anywhere do another job.
Right. A Montreal suburb, as I call it, Isle of Mont. So it's interesting.
Which is one of my favorite towns in the entire state. Do want to mention Rusty DeWeese going to be at Higher Ground tomorrow night. So I'll be at that show. It'll be great to see him. Let's go to Burlington. We've got Dale on the line. Hi, Dale. Go right ahead.
Yes, good morning. Hello, Mike. Been a long time, no chat.
Hi, Dale.
Over the last 20 years, there's probably not been a more influential person in Vermont politics or Vermont business than you. I'd just like to thank you and congratulate you on a fantastic career. But a man does have to know his limitations. And you do know that you will never be as good as the jockey, Mike Smith.
I'll never be as light as the jockey as Mike Smith either. But, Dale, thank you. That's awful kind.
All right. Beautiful comment. All right. And let's go to Eden next. We've got Brian on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hey. I just had to say I got a huge kick out of what Rusty said. And I know you're loving your retirement, Mike, but Jeff Nicholson doesn't quite qualify as an all-star, but he worked the security at the airport forever. He used to work at DEV back with Anson, I believe, was his intern at one point. But he has the record for being fired the most by 10 in one day. So I don't know if that qualifies him as an all-star or not. But you can always get in touch with good old Jeff Nicholson. But anyway, if Jeff and Rusty, they gang up on you, you will be running the airport.
Thanks, Brian, so much.
Anything on your bucket list, places to visit, anything you want to do, or are you just happy to be where you are right now?
I'm happy where we are right now.
Sure.
We're planning, you know, each April we try to plan a trip. We do a lot of rail trail biking and so we're planning a trip right now in terms of where we'll be in April for a rail trail bike trip. We went from Pittsburgh to Washington, D.C. on rail trails 1 year, and that was fabulous, and we got hooked. And now we plan to do those.
Yeah. We got about a minute left, but if you came back to host one more show, just one more, who would you invite as your guest? It's almost like the who would you have dinner with, you know, of all the people in history. But who would your guests be?
You know, that is interesting. I could do anybody in the world.
Yeah, sure.
Putin.
Oh, brilliant.
I'd
give him the whole 2 hours, too.
Yeah, I would give him the whole 2 hours. I'd like to know what's in his brain.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting.
I'd like to challenge him and see how he feels about being challenged.
Well, here's the deal. So if you get him to agree, I'll give you the day. I'll even run the board. I'll be the director for you. I'll be happy to call Russia, set up the phone call, and have you interview Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be on.
I don't think so. Too bad. Mike Smith is a WDEV All-Star and a State of Vermont All-Star. Mike, it's been a pleasure having you on the show this morning. Thank you.
Rick, you've been so kind. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint was directed by Lee Cattell. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. And the podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when I speak with Bob Ney. We hear about from the new state librarian, Catherine Delneo, and from singer Allie McGurk.